Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the Mobilities and Methods series. This series is hosted by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. The Mobilities and Methods Lab and New Books Network partnership provides a platform for authors, readers, and their interlocutors to engage closely with questions of mobility and movement. I'm your host, Aliza Arıcan. Today, I'm joined by Eray Çaylı, the Leverhulme Trust Early Career Fellow at the European Institute at the London School of Economics. We'll be talking about his book, Victims of Commemoration, The Architecture and Violence of Confronting the Past in Turkey, recently published by Syracuse University Press. Thank you very much, Eray, for joining us today.
Thank you very much indeed, Aliza. I'm very happy to be here and looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, I have to say, it's a really special pleasure to have you here because long before this book, I've been following your public writings, which span architecture, geography, and anthropology. So first off, I was wondering if you could tell us about this interdisciplinary background and how it informed this book project.
Thank you so much for these kind words. They mean a lot. Me, especially coming from a scholar like yourself, whose work bridges exactly those disciplines to fill an important gap in our knowledge about urban renewal and how marginalized communities respond to urban renewal in Istanbul. You're right that my background is interdisciplinary. This book is based on my PhD at University College London, which was co-supervised by the School of Architecture and the Anthropology Department. Now, since 2012, I've designed and taught courses on the spatial and visual politics of violence and conflict at architecture schools, art history departments, and most recently at what one may call a area studies department, that is the European Institute at LSE, London School of Economics and Political Science, where I work since 2016. It's a department that also has a kind of strong political science and international relations component. My research articles have appeared mainly in geography journals, further diversifying that interdisciplinary mix. And in Turkey, I've written regularly for non-academic publications on architecture and urbanism. My pre-PhD formation further complexifies things as I had a I did a BSc and an MFA in design disciplines. So indeed, the story of this book actually began during my master's, which was in Stockholm. Halfway through it in 2009, I won a scholarship to attend the summer school on memorialization in Lithuania's capital, Vilnius, of all places. And here I encountered an incredibly rich, multi-layered history of violence and memory, and a kind of a profoundly complex landscape of memorials that sort of, for me, shed light on what was then happening in Turkey. So in Turkey, discourses of confronting the past geçmişle yüzleşme, and reckoning with the past, geçmişle hesaplaşma, that had been initiated in the mid to late 1990s by activists and intellectuals were in the process of becoming mainstream in the late 2000s, early 2010s. The AKP government had just begun to speak this language of confronting the past, reckoning with the past, as part of a series of democratization initiatives called Açılım or Açılımlar in plural, through which it promised to address long-standing kind of issues affecting Turkey's historically marginalized communities, such as Alevis, Kurds, non-Muslims. Histories of state-sponsored violence were prominent among these issues, and members of such communities and their political allies had long been leading campaigns for the transformation of sites of violence, state-sponsored violence, that is, into memorial museums. And often actually referencing the case of Germany and Holocaust memorialization at such sites as concentration camps and the like. And the government now, as part of its kind of democratization initiative, was now having to engage with these kind of campaigns. And this book obviously discusses the three sites that were really kind of central to these campaigns for memorial museums at sites of state-sponsored violence. And these sites are the Ulucanlar prison in Ankara, where leaders of Turkey's 1968 student movement were hanged under the influence of the military. Diyarbakır prison, where pro-Kurdish activists were tortured by the 1980s junta. And the Madımak Hotel in Sivas, where an arson attack targeted the participants of an Alevi-run culture festival in 1993, before the eyes of an inactive law enforcement and thousands of mostly supportive onlookers. So all three sites, again, have been subject to campaigns for memorial museums. So, you know, architecture obviously was a prominent kind of medium through which these discourses of confronting the past, reckoning with the past, had developed and were now being kind of thrust into the mainstream. Yet, architecture remained quite posterior to these kind of discourses, or kind of somewhat external to the critical debate on these kind of policies of Açılım, of confronting the past. Sites of violence and what they could architecturally become had yet to be really kind of taken seriously as a departure point for politics of confronting the past, as a kind of realm of memory politics unto itself. And instead, I felt that these sites were largely treated, or at least architecturally speaking, treated as a kind of illustration of memory politics, as something that develops elsewhere, right? And this was especially the case in scholarship, in terms of the debate that was taking place among public intellectuals. Now, am I allowed a detour?
Of course.
Yes. So something that's not in the book. Hopefully this will be interesting for the listeners. To return to Vilnius, where that summer school was taking place in 2009, we had, obviously I was a master's student back then. I was attending lectures by some really prominent names associated with the kind of boom in Holocaust memorialization that took place in the post-Cold War period. Some names like Horst Hochheisel, Esther Schalev-Gertz. But the program of that summer school also involved field kind of visits and fieldwork, really, to numerous sites of memory. And this is where I encountered really interesting kind of parallels with what's happening in Turkey. Lithuania, obviously a post-Soviet country in the 90s, in the 2000s, had been interested in questions of memory more as, a way of boosting self-confidence, right? But now with the integration into the EU, which obviously was relevant to what was happening in Turkey, now a kind of more of a concern for self-reflexive engagement with the past was coming about, particularly in terms of Holocaust. And the country, I felt, was kind of questioning its own complicity in the Holocaust. And that was interesting, which obviously, again, was linked to EU integration, and in that sense, linked in a way to what was happening in Turkey. Simultaneously, I felt that there was this kind of really interesting revival of imperial history, which it turns out Lithuania also has in terms of its kind of Grand Duchy of Lithuania, which was kind of this political kind of formation, a country really, that existed between the 13th and 18th centuries, which again, in Turkey, you know, on the one hand, you have this kind of confronting with the past, this kind of discourse, but also obviously an Ottomanist revival. So I was really interested in how these kind of practices of confronting, you know, quite dark pasts in terms of, you know, state-sponsored violence were kind of perhaps happening, unfolding alongside a redefining of nationalism through and by reference to kind of imperialist pasts, right? So so that really kind of resonated with me. And but then I also saw really interesting memorials and talked to their makers where, you know, it had nothing to do with the kind of communitarian affiliations that we're accustomed to when it comes to state-sponsored violence. I encountered, for instance, a Soviet-era monument with kind of quite muscular male figures in it, which, you know, amidst all the post-Soviet era monuments being demolished when Lithuania became a kind of independent country, obviously they wanted to kind of leave that past behind, a group of gay activists actually claimed that monument because basically it looked nice. And this kind of, really interestingly, this kind of symbol of, you know, Soviet era fraternity became a symbol of, became appropriated as a symbol of, you know, gay solidarity. And so this was really interesting. Another such case was, you know, a group of kind of artists campaigning to build a monument to Frank Zappa in the 90s.
Okay.
Because they thought, you know, why don't we have our own monument to, you know, someone that we like? If you know, Lithuania is now becoming liberal and independent and a kind of post-Soviet country, we want our own monument. And they kind of, you know, and each of these campaigns were really painstaking, actually. But they were kind of non-sectarian. They kind of showed how, and bear in mind, you know, this is, again, the late 2000s when you didn't yet have these kind of movements that we have that are really also interesting and complex, like, you know, roads must fall, you know, various fallisms, etc. But these really were kind of cases where I saw, you know, people can actually use memorialization as a way of organizing and mobilizing, right? And in a way that is kind of future-oriented, in a way that is not necessarily kind of ethnically based, in a way that is actually generative, or at least that actually showed how memorials can be generative of politics. The very processes by which memorials are built, designed, you know, campaigned for, can be generative of politics rather than just reflective of politics. So I kind of wanted to approach what was happening in Turkey in that same light. So that's really my interdisciplinary journey. You know, I guess a few characters have become more pronounced since this unlikeliest of beginnings in Vilnius in terms of this particular book. First, this kind of approach that I have that considers materiality and spatiality, again, as not simply kind of reflective of politics, but rather generative of politics, which is what my formation in design and architecture has given me, this kind of object-oriented approach. Secondly, I think I've gotten from anthropology, you know, I've learned from anthropology, gotten out of anthropology, a kind of hands-on, ethnographically informed, fieldwork-based kind of approach. in terms of geography, why I've published mainly in geography journals, because I'm still interested in, you know, quite geopolitical kind of questions. And I obviously use a material and spatial focus to engage with quite, you know, systemic and structural political questions. And that's why I found a home, in a way, in geography. And the final kind of characteristic, I guess, is one that resists the traditional area studies appetite for regional exceptionalism, which is why the story of a book on Turkey, like this one, could begin in Lithuania, and why I've actually been fortunate enough over the past decade or so to, you know, design and teach my own courses on violence and conflict that have really, you know, haven't had a regional focus on the Middle East or Turkey as such. And yet, obviously, have always been grounded in the kind of situated perspective that I'm able to offer as someone who hails from, works on, and endeavors to speak for that region.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is incredible. I would have never guessed that, you know, maybe in a way the origins of this book would be in Vilnius. So, you know, you also show us that besides moving between disciplines, just moving in general can generate thinking about a place, even, you know, if you're from there. And, you know, I want to pick up on the built environment, which you mentioned in passing. And, you know, I'm really curious about how, you know, you use built environment as something generative, but in specific generative of violence, commemoration, and victimhood. So could you elaborate on that link?
Sure. Perhaps I could begin by answering through references to, you know, some basic information about the three sites that I discuss in this book. So my fieldwork began in 2011. When campaigns for the kind of memorial museums I just mentioned reached unprecedented visibility and actually began yielding practical results. Recall that this was a time when Turkey was still seen globally, you know, unlike now, seen as a beacon of democracy in the Middle East, right? I put that in quotation marks, with government representatives, you know, being invited to publish, you know, op-eds in The Guardian, in, you know, Newsweek, and the like. In 2011, the authorities turned Ulucanlar Prison into a memorial museum proper. They redesigned the Madımak Hotel, the site of the Sivas arson attack, as a commemorative slash educational space called the Science and Culture Center, with a memory corner dedicated to the arson attack as its centerpiece. Around the same time, senior cabinet members, including the then Prime Minister, you know, Erdoğan himself, pledged to close the Diyarbakır prison, and or even, you know, turn it into a museum, although this never materialized. So the three sites I discuss in this book are united in being at the heart of these campaigns for site-specific memorial museums, but also have their differences in terms of what they have or haven't become. Ulucanlar, again, is a museum proper, open to the public. The building where the Sivas arson attack took place is now open to the public as well, as a kind of, you know, public institution. And its centerpiece is a memory corner, but it's not a museum. Diyarbakır prison remains a prison. But activists, and this is really crucial, continue to annually organize commemorations in Sivas that center around the site of the arson attack. And at the time of my fieldwork, a similar mass commemoration was also taking place in Diyarbakır. So in Turkey, one of the kind of prominent ways in which these sites have been understood, and I guess this holds for other similar sites in the rest of the world as well, is kind of to focus exclusively on what they function as, what they've become. You know, whether, you know, have they become memorial museums? Have they not become memorial museums? And then kind of to appraise these sites based on those kind of, representational merits on how they represent the past, etc. Now, obviously, activists are absolutely right in prioritizing this kind of a focus. That's what their campaigns are by definition for and about. And they're, you know, keen on achieving this museum outcome. And obviously, there's nothing absolutely wrong with that. But critical debate, however, around these kind of sites, I think falls short if it abandons a site like, say, the site of the Sivas arson attack purely on the basis of it's not having become a museum proper. It falls short because it kind of overlooks that for better or for worse, memory politics continue to develop and unfold at this kind of a site, regardless of its prescribed function. So this is something I wanted to kind of shift focus from, to really kind of look at what's happening at these sites, the kind of daily goings on at these sites, what kinds of people visit them, particularly using, or you could say capitalizing on the fact that two of them were now open to the public, right? So I wanted to also use this kind of functional diversity, so to speak, that characterizes these three sites for taking stock of the varying kinds of political work they generate. I wanted to approach the built environment as two things, mainly. First, as a medium, again, going back to what I said earlier, as a medium for organizing social relations, right? And secondly, as a technology, right? So regardless of whether, again, a site of violence becomes a museum or not, it kind of serves as a medium for organizing social relations in ways that cement or contest the violent history. I discuss, for example, in the book, how in transforming both the former Madımak Hotel and Ulucanlar prison, the authorities have sought to leave the violent history behind and to progress society into what's supposed to be a kind of brighter, more democratic future. And at both these sites, there's a kind of quite salient air of provisionality that the authorities present to the public as a kind of democratic quality. So visitors to these sites, Ulucanlar and what used to be Madımak Hotel, which are again now open to the public, are told by employees that each site is an unfinished project and that visitor feedback is being collected so that they may be improved. These sites may be improved moving forward. And this kind of, I think, resonates with, I know of your interest in delays, right? These kind of delays in these kinds of state-sponsored projects that serve as a platform for producing and enacting political power in their own right. So there's a kind of similar thing going on there. Indeed, you know, there are actually empty floors in the former Madımak Hotel, for example, which are now presented to visitors as evidence of the authorities' openness to the public's suggestions as to what may become of this site in the future. But the crucial thing is, let alone helping to move society towards a better democratic future, I found that these emphases on provisionality actually extend the violent history into the future. For example, this kind of emphasis on provisionality prompts far-right groups to speculate that the site will soon become a place of Alevi worship closed to the wider public, that it's going to be kind of closed, it's going to be exclusive, kind of dovetailing with a kind of conspiracy theoretical mindset and a conspiracy theoretical reading of the arson attack that sees it as a kind of external plot orchestrated by powers that are against Turkey's unity, and that actually obviously problematically sees even some of the victims as pawns in this kind of conspiracy. Importantly, the built environment is also a technology, and it's a political realm unto itself by virtue of its being a technology as well.
Again, in the book, I discuss how as seemingly mundane an act as painting walls can turn out to serve as a technology of contending with violence and in quite unexpected ways. The one kind of specific example I have in mind is from the 1980s Diyarbakir prison, where a kind of prominent torture method was to force political inmates to paint the prison's walls with racist nationalist slogans and symbols. The torturers often spoke of the prison as a school, and the forced painting was for them a method of educating the prisoners about becoming, you know, better Turks, or kind of Turkifying them. And this technology was then repurposed by actually four prisoners who killed themselves by self-immolation in May 1982 to protest against the torture that was taking place there. These prisoners had gradually and kind of secretly stockpiled, you know, enough of the kind of combustible materials, you know, paint and varnish and the like, that were, you know, that they were forced to use to paint the walls. Now, this was obviously an act of defiance against the anti-Kurdish violence that was taking place in the prison, and you could say beyond, in Turkey. But also it actually, and this is what veteran prisoners kind of have told me, it also had quite direct practical consequences for day-to-day life in the prison. The policy of forced painting came to an end after this kind of act of self-immolation, because the authorities began to fear further instances of such self-immolation. So they kind of stopped this kind of policy of forced painting, and therefore, you know, this kind of form of torture was eliminated. Now, in the late 2000s, when you had, you know, discourses of confronting the past beginning to figure prominently, and when the kind of transformation of Diyarbakir prison into a memorial museum was becoming a kind of the subject of a debate, the authorities wanted to show their willingness to move on from the violent history by collaborating with the local university's art education department and students from there, whom they got to decorate the prison's outer walls. The art students were told to decorate the outer walls of the prison with duplicates of Miro's and Picasso's well-known paintings, as well as, you know, education-themed quotes from European figures like Balzac, etc. Survivors of the prison, when I talked to them, found this really kind of reminiscent, problematically, troublingly reminiscent of how the torturers actually had forced them to paint the inner walls as part of their kind of indoctrination in Turkishness. So there are kind of technological aspects, if you consider, for instance, this idea of, you know, painting the walls, etc., as a kind of technology. There are kind of technological aspects of the built environment that serve as political mechanisms in their own right, that kind of bring along their own political meanings that they've acquired through history, and not least, obviously, histories of violence. There's a final kind of instance which involves, I don't know if this actually qualifies as built environment, but it involves a kind of apricot orchard. You know, insofar as orchards are planted, right? Mm-hmm. They're not natural environments.
Altered environment. To the environment, yeah.
Exactly. They're not natural environments, strictly speaking, but you could call them actually built environments. Without wanting to give any spoilers, you know, I discuss in the book an instance where an apricot orchard prompts an Alevi activist to kind of interweave, and actually unintentionally interweave, the Sivas arson attack with the Armenian genocide, which obviously is a kind of history of genocide that has kind of entangled Turkey's histories of modern capitalist development in racial nation building. So I think, yeah, in short, I think the politics that kind of is inherent in the technology that constitutes built environments can also serve to make trans-ethnic non-sectarian connections, like, you know, between the Armenian genocide and, you know, the Sivas massacre, that are otherwise each kind of assumed to be only of concern to a particular community.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Wow, Erai, thanks so much for this really rich response. Like, you show us that, you know, if we take spatial lenses seriously, you know, we can also understand the temporal dynamics between violence and commemoration, as well as how spaces actually speak back and generate new forms of politics. So I really appreciated that. And it's very obvious that this comes out of a very rich sort of spatial ethnography. And my next question is about that. So, you know, I was really struck with your ability to move between and stitch together different spaces like prisons, public squares, museums, among others that you just mentioned. So could you speak to the methodological approach that led you to this multi-sited and interstitched spatial ethnography?
I'm really happy to hear you refer to the book as a spatial ethnography. I guess one of the modest ways in which I try and reimagine ethnography involves situating space as ethnography's protagonist, you know, rather than the usual approach of individuals being such protagonists. I try to bring to the fore the histories of modern violence that constitute space and yet are often also concealed by space. And since these histories, by definition, build on and unfold along nonlinear trajectories that sort of traverse and interconnect multiple spaces and times, you obviously have to, you know, kind of stitch together these different kind of temporal, actually, and spatial sites. In terms of the specific examples, in terms of the spatial types that you refer to in your question, public squares, prisons, museums, obviously, the links between these have been made by various thinkers throughout the 20th century, from Georges Bataille through, Michel Foucault, George Agamben, Tony Bennett, who really have kind of pointed out the relationship between, slaughterhouses, museums, prisons, public squares, and the like, as kind of technologies of rule by bodily discipline, right? My approach obviously owes a great deal to this kind of thinking and this kind of scholarship, but I also differ from it in certain ways. And I suppose the main difference has to do with how I do not see the politics of these kind of spatial technologies as impacting everyone equally, and how I instead kind of focus their kind of politics of bodily discipline on mutually contesting claims, mutually conflicting claims, and the work that is put into enacting those kind of political claims. So in kind of approaching these kind of disciplinary spatial technologies and how, you know, emphasizing how their consequences aren't even. Obviously, I'm not just kind of emphasizing unevenness for emphasis sake, but also actually to say it's really to say that their oppressive politics is also not inevitable, right? So there are other ways of kind of using them and responding to them. Again, to maybe refer to concrete examples from the book, you could take the Sivas arson attack that took place in 1993, which was a period when Turkey was supposedly witnessing the expansion of the public sphere. You know, it was supposed to be recovering from the violent coup that took place in 1980. The culture festival that was targeted in the Sivas arson attack was organized by representatives of the Alevi community, very much as an attempt to take part in this expansion of the public sphere that was supposed to be taking place in the 1990s. The festival had actually previously been organized elsewhere. This was the fourth time that the festival was taking place. But previously, it had been organized in the countryside in an Alevi village called Banaz. And it had a kind of exclusively Alevism-related lineup of events and contributors. Now, for the first time, the festival was being held in central Sivas, and actually the program and the participants were not only Alevism-oriented. It was very much this kind of staking of a claim for publicness and doing it spatially, right? Kind of opening up to central Sivas, etc. That actually was targeted in the arson attack. Highly mediated images of, you know, thousands that converged around the Madımak Hotel at the time of the arson, during the arson, replaced the festival organizers and participants as the correct, the ideal public that constitutes the publicness of public space. And as a result of this, and atrocities like this arson attack, actually many Alevis fled to Europe. And for the first time, they found the opportunity to organize formally, officially as Alevis, especially in Germany to begin with. Once they grouped in or regrouped in places like Germany, they actually began to travel back to Sivas to commemorate the arson attack, but now were cast as foreigners because they were based in Germany, because they actually fled the violence, right? And now that they were based in Germany, was kind of repurposed, exploited as a kind of a fact almost that, or in terms of the idea that they were foreigners, right? Not unlike the foreign powers that were supposedly behind such violent episodes as the arson attack itself. So quite a cyclical kind of reasoning that we encounter here that actually characterizes, you know, conspiracy theoretical thinking. So, but once again, one clearly sees how organizing and mobilizing is what spatial technologies of bodily discipline are selectively and unevenly wielded against, right? And unpacking this kind of uneven politics of places like public squares, public space, museums, prisons, requires that we traverse multiple spaces, like those very spaces, but also, you know, multiple geographies, like, you know, Sivas, central Sivas, the village of Banaz, and I mean the Madımak Hotel, as well as, you know, cities in Germany. All of which are actually places I did fieldwork in and kind of discuss in this book.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I love what you said at the beginning about taking space as a protagonist. And you take it as not a static protagonist, so to speak, but one that circulates. For example, throughout the book, besides, you know, the actual physical spaces and spatial technologies, you pay attention to artwork, media, as well as everyday interactions to understand what space does politically. So I'm curious about what circulation does for you methodologically as well.
This is a really crucial question, and I'm glad you bring up artworks and images, because obviously you know, the sites I discuss in this book are such that there's no way of discussing them without taking into account the ways they've been mediated visually. All three are associated with events that took place in the neoliberal era that gradually also became an era of, you know, breaking news, instantaneous communication, image saturation in Turkey. The Sivas arson attack is the obvious example where, you know, we have a kind of atrocity that was near live broadcast. And not only that, but also the TV network reporting from the scene, and this is what I argue in the book, also played an active role in instigating the atrocity. Now, in terms of Ulucanlar prison, footage from a crackdown that took place there in 1999 on inmates protesting against the introduction of solitary confinement was featured similarly prominently in the media. If you grew up in the 1990s, in Turkey in the 1990s, like I did, and especially if you're coming from a family that's in one way or another affected by such political events, these visuals are forever ingrained in your memory, in your childhood memory. The Diyarbakir prison was evidently less exposed, due to its being prison, less exposed to the media. But the fact that the torture of Kurdish and pro-Kurdish political prisoners was taking place here simultaneously with a supposed opening up of Turkish society and politics in the mid to late 1980s meant that those trying to create awareness about the torture were actually met with disbelief among significant sections of Turkey's intelligentsia. It was kind of like, oh, wow, I think you're imagining this. You know, there are actually actual events, actual quotes confronting Kurdish activists trying to create awareness about the Diyarbakir prison, where Turkish kind of intellectuals say, well, you're just imagining this because obviously, you know, we're way past the coup now. Turkey is democratizing, etc. You know, so this kind of discourse of democratization was already taking place in the late 1980s. So whether in its kind of saturation or in its absence, mediation, and especially visual mediation, was already a defining feature of these sites or the histories of violence that took place in these sites. So my ethnography features not only the sites themselves, but also how they've been portrayed in visual culture. And it features, for example, a series of drawings by Zulfikar Tak, a survivor of Diyarbakir prison, filmmaker Mraz Bezar, who co-wrote and directed the film Mundit, where Diyarbakir prison figures prominently. I discuss, you know, works by Ulucanlar survivor Murat Özçelik, who produced a documentary about the 1999 crackdown, and Medet Dilek, who produced a documentary about the Sivas arson attack with footage from mainstream media as well as from the personal cameras of Alevi residents of the city, who kind of sort of counter-documented the events from their own marked, situated perspective. So the kind of profoundly mediated nature of these sites obviously also renders everyday interactions with these sites that took place today highly complex and multi-layered, because everyone, virtually everyone, again, who's witnessed the 1990s, you know, has some kind of mental image of the kind of violent events that took place at these sites. This, of course, you know, this kind of supposed familiarity, the fact that, you know, you could say nearly everyone who's seen, who's lived, experienced the 1990s in Turkey has some kind of idea of and visual idea of these sites, cuts both ways, right? So for some, it may mean that, oh, they already know what happened fully, right? Because they've seen the footage, right? So it's that kind of quite problematic faith in the fact that, you know, something that is visually documented is subject to the same idea of truth, right? But for others, also, it actually means that they have a kind of material framework, materially charged framework, and a mental image of it in their minds, within which they can situate the experiences that they have in the present, and how, you know, they can draw these kind of qualitative connections between what they're experiencing during something like a commemoration, right? Where barricades are set up in Sivas, right? And they can then say, well, how about, you know, the barricades that were not set up at this very site during the arson attack, which could have prevented the arsonists from, you know, setting the place ablaze, right? So so it's both a potential, I'd say, and a limitation that these kind of events have been widely visually mediated.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And no, you mentioned how spaces were mediated. So I want to ask you more about how you mediated space, so to speak, through your positionality. And, you know, I was struck really with this quote from the book, where you take positionality as not only a form of being, but a form of doing and relating that's ultimately shaped by the agency of your interlocutors. So I'm curious about what positionality came to mean to you throughout the book and throughout your time across these sites.
Yeah, thank you for that question. And this is really, really important coming from an anthropologist like yourself. As well. And I've obviously learned a great deal from anthropologists, right, in thinking about what one's positionality might mean for one's research. Still, as you kind of alluded to, I find that the focus of debates on fieldwork positionality tends to be on who people are rather than what they do, right? And sometimes this is kind of like a question of, you know, where people come from, etc., which I kind of discuss also in the book. So the kind of question of where one is from and who one is, obviously kind of linked to what one does. There's no doubt about that. But I think I fear the question about origins, essentially, you know, this is a question about origins, right? The question of, you know, who you are, where you come from. I fear that it often overshadows the one about doing, the question about doing. In my fieldwork, I was, of course, repeatedly asked, you know, where I'm from, memleket nere? As someone who's neither Kurdish nor Alevi, I actually never felt this question signified a constraint. I felt that rather it kind of helped folks to map me onto geographies that they are familiar with. And of course, in using the word mapping, I use it quite literally, and I discuss it in the book as well. I'm thinking spatially here, right? So once interlocutors were able to map me quite literally onto a familiar geography, the focus of our conversation would shift to what we do, what we're interested in doing. And often this was actually the reason why I was there to talk to them in the first place. I was there to talk to them because they were, again, filmmakers, because they were photographers, because they were campaigners actively campaigning to turn sites of violence into museums. So I was actually interested in their work as what one may call commemorative workers, right? So as such, they were also interested in my own work, how I approached the topic. More difficult for me was the question, more difficult than, that is, the question of where I'm from, was the question of what I was there to contribute. I was asked, you know, what new light I could possibly shed on a subject that's already been extensively researched. And the fact is that, yeah, indeed, many of these communities and their members have actually written books about, say, the Sivas massacre, Diyarbakir prison. There's extensive kind of community literature, activist literature on these kind of subjects. So the question is totally valid. And I was asked this the whole time. And in response, I would simply expose my you know, methodological premise to folks. And I would say, you know, that I acknowledge that a lot of work has been done. And the debate on these sites of violence is really extensive. But
I found that space could be taken more of a taken as more of a departure point, right? And this was this kind of response that I gave, which was about methodology, really, was really welcomed by many of my interlocutors, who would then go on to use me as a sounding board for their rough ideas on architectures of commemoration. So they really kind of agreed often that this was kind of a missing perspective. So really, it's that kind of section on positionality that you're referring to comes out of these kind of conversations where I really encountered the work, the importance of the work that one does, rather than simply where one is from or who one is.
Yeah, that is really, really important. And I also feel like often, you know, what we do during fieldwork tends to be sidelined, which really informs the work itself. And, you know, this brings me to my next question, which builds on, you know, my question on agency of your interlocutors, right? Like towards the end of the book, you share an instance where you were expelled from your field site, one of your field sites. And I'm, you know, very curious about, you know, how you came to sharing this instance, first of all, and then how it informed your empirical and methodological thinking around victimhood and public space.
I wanted to include this instance from my fieldwork for, I guess, two reasons. The first was to nuance what at the time was, you know, the mainstream image, globally speaking, that Turkey had in the early 2010s still, where analysts and commentators across the political spectrum were saying that Turkey is a beacon of democracy in the Middle East, et cetera, et cetera. And now, actually, you know, and since the late 2010s, we seem to have switched to the exact opposite extreme, where Turkey is a political hell, right? So my point in sharing this kind of expulsion story, where someone who is a researcher, who is as seemingly unmarginalized as myself, managed to be able to be expelled from a field site at a time when Turkey was globally seen as a beacon of democracy in the Middle East. And even as I had already been given permission to work in the building. My point in sharing this kind of expulsion story is to show that neither political hells nor political paradises don't exist as such for everyone in a given political context, and that and that they have, again, uneven kind of consequences, implications for different people. Listeners will be able to find, you know, further details of the expulsion itself in the book, of course. But to come to the second reason why I wanted to share this kind of expulsion story was to show how even the most restrictive moments during fieldwork can serve as opportunities for knowledge production, and how field workers actually can learn from interlocutors, not only as empirical sources, but also methodological teachers. So this has to do with how I followed up on my expulsion by writing and submitting an official letter to the governorship 9 months after the event itself, where I kind of recapped the entire episode of my expulsion and demanded that my access to the building be reinstated. The reply I received 6 months after ended with a rejection, but also actually elaborated on the Science and Culture Center project and its main commemorative kind of centerpiece, that is the Memory Corner. It kind of effectively served as the first ever publicly accessible and official record of the authorities' rationale behind why they transformed the building. Because this kind of document hasn't been released about this building. The building was actually transformed quite secretively. It never was actually inaugurated ceremonially, etc., etc. Going back to, again, this kind of idea of this processuality, this kind of provisionality being a mechanism of power onto itself. So they said in their letter to me, in which they rejected my kind of demand or my appeal, They said, and I quote, "A memory corner has been constituted inside the building to the memory of the saddening events that took place here that the entire country would rather not remember." So in saying that the entire country wouldn't want to remember this, this atrocity, they effectively gave a record of how the authorities identify those kind of committed to remembering this atrocity as the nation's other, right? So you could see how this kind of communication around my expulsion actually, again, served as a kind of knowledge production opportunity in its own right. Now, what's also interesting, and this is where we come back to your question of agency and how one might actually learn from interlocutors methodologically, not only kind of approach them as sources of, you know, data, but actually learn from their politics of methodology as well, right? So in deciding to embark on this kind of written correspondence with the authorities, I, in effect, adopted what I call in the book the memory activists' insistence on rational critical methods. So what does this mean? So I find much of the kind of work on commemoration, on protest, etc., is geared towards or kind of almost idealizes performance, spontaneity. So a lot of the literature references how, you know, groups just come up in public space, stage a protest, they interrupt linear temporality, etc., which obviously is crucial. But what I found in the field was also the importance of sustained, committed, kind of longer standing work of organizing and mobilizing alongside direct action, alongside spontaneous performance, right? So activists were using what I call rational critical methods, this kind of sustained work of organizing, mobilizing, in... For instance, insisting that state-sponsored memorial museums be built at sites of violence, despite their awareness, you know, of the political limitations of, you know, memorial museums. You know, memorial museums, you know, they're aware, our activists are aware that memorial museums aren't perfect as a kind of type, of as a commemorative type, right? They have their problems. But still, they were doing what I would call... campaigning for what you would want to take down, right? So in insisting on memorial museums, right? So public space, their attitude towards notions of public space, similarly kind of twofold, right? So on the one hand, obviously they're using the kind of whatever potentials exist of existing models of public space to make the most of them as social spatial infrastructures, but also problematizing the idealization of existing models of public space, right? So here one can think of, you know, specific examples like lawsuits that activists filed against the memory corner, because actually the memory corner includes a kind of all-encompassing name list that includes two people who were known to have been among the crowd that surrounded the arson, the Madmak Hotel during the arson attack, right? So there's this kind of idea that they have, the authorities have, in creating this memory corner, including these two names, that they do not discriminate between the dead because they see as they see the arson attack as a kind of plot against the entire nation, right? So activists have actually filed lawsuits against this memory corner, which is quite a boring, you know, quite a bureaucratic kind of thing to do, right? But it's important. It's important. And, you know, there's a lot of talk in especially in Turkey right now, oh, like the law doesn't work, courts don't work. But still, I really appreciate, and I think it's really important, this insistence, right, on using whatever kind of legal mechanism is out there. As, again, as a knowledge production mechanism, you can then use the knowledge that that kind of mechanism produces for your political kind of project. So this is what I kind of learned from, I think, in adopting this insistence on rational critical methods. My friends and family told me, why are you writing this letter? Obviously, they're going to reject you. You know, obviously, and not only that, but also you're going to get yourself into further trouble, right? I said, no, I'm going to do this because this is what I've learned from you know, the activists that I worked among, right? And this was my way of kind of adopting some of their rational critical methods And my way of showing how field works can actually relate to interlocutors, not only as data sources, right, but also as actors with political methodological agency.
Indeed, and I think that loops back so nicely that, you know, as soon as you don't see people or places we work with as, you know, things to extract data from and build relationships, they also impact what you do, like the work that you do during field work, which is something you touched upon. So I really appreciated that. And, you know, we've spoken a bit about the future and the past. So my last question is, what is next for you? What are some new projects or questions or even classes that you're working on?
So more recently, I've been exploring violence's links with ecology, or exploring violence as an environmental question in the sense of the politics of ecology. And here, it's interesting how you mentioned extracting data, because I've actually started to work on extractivism. So part of my work violence and ecology, on the imbrications of violence and ecology, is about extractivism, and particularly in Turkey's Kurdistan. And listeners can find out more about this by looking at my recent articles in Antipode and Transactions of the Institute of British Geographers. The basic kind of, I guess, position or argument there is that I try to show how extractivism, again, maybe going back to this kind of mythological discussion that we had, is not only a question of or a matter of industries of extraction proper, like, you know, mining, but also it's a question of visual and spatial cultural production and also theorization of this production. So I just finished drafting on this topic what I hope will be my second English language monograph, which is kind of tentatively titled Aesthetics of Extractivism, Visual Ecologies of Violence and Agency in Turkey's Kurdistan. So actually, much of this book is grounded in my collaborations, kind of, again, resonating with the discussion, the conversation that we just had on agency. I've tried to kind of engage even more with interlocutors in field sites as you know, collaborators proper. And I've been collaborating with an artist-run organization, for instance, in Ahmed, or Diyarbakir in Kurdish, which is kind of, you know, sociocultural and political heart of Turkey's Kurdistan. And it's an organization called Loading that was set up by artists, two contemporary artists called Cengiz Tekin and Erkan Özgen. And I've run kind of workshops with them, various projects with them, kind of free of charge, open to you know, everyone who's able to apply. I've also been working on, you know, violence and ecology with a focus on the notion of emergency. So emergency rule as something that obviously resonates with current discussions around climate change. You know, we speak of the climate emergency, but I also show how we must appraise these kind of emphases on the climate emergency in specific contexts with specific references to kind of particular histories of emergency rule, such as in Turkey, particularly in Kurdish regions, right? So I co-edited recently an anthology called Architectures of Emergency in Turkey that was published by IB Torres in Bloomsbury. I co-edited that with Pınar Aykaç and Sevcan Ercan. I actually, going back to, again, interlocutors and fieldwork, I co-authored a chapter in that anthology with someone who I consider obviously an interlocutor, but also a friend now, Herdem Doğrul, who's an Ahmed-based architect and activist. And I've also collaborated with him to coordinate, you know, a free of charge summer school in Ahmed. So that kind of interest in collaborating with interlocutors obviously continues. You know, I've published various other things on this idea of emergency, and how mainstream responses to environmental emergencies, especially in the context of disaster preparedness, are shaped by stately traditions of emergency rule. What else? A collection of the essays I wrote in Turkish on the Anthropocene was published recently, well, relatively recently, a year and a half ago now. It's called Iklimin Esteti, which kind of roughly translates as climate aesthetics, and is apparently about to enter its second print run. So although this book is absolutely worthless in terms of the performance metrics of neoliberal academia, I still wanted to publish my thoughts in a language that my interlocutors and collaborators can understand. And so again, this is part of my modest attempt to reciprocate some of the generosity they've approached me with. And I hope to be able to continue doing this kind of work in multiple languages, in spite of the challenges facing all of us academic workers who come from one place and try to survive in an altogether different one.
Well, on this, I don't know, rather sad, but also maybe a more real note. Thank you very much, Eray, for joining us and for your insights. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you so much indeed for taking the time to engage with the book with such care and attention to detail, and for being such a generous host.
Oh, of course. It was truly my pleasure. This is your host, Aliza Arıcan. This discussion of victims of commemoration, the architecture and violence of confronting the past in Turkey, published by Syracuse University Press in 2022, is brought to you by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Thank you for listening.